Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome back to Death by Champagne, the podcast here to keep you up at night. We are here with our next multi-part series covering the book, The Last Madame, A Life in the New Orleans Underworld by Christine Wiltz. This week, we dive into our main character, Norma Wallace. Her youth in Memphis and New Orleans prior to becoming one of the biggest names in the industry, and we take a look at New Orleans history, how it came to be known as one of the most sinful places in the world. This episode contains foul language, discussions about the sex work industry, statutory rape, poverty, and New Orleans underworld. We'll do our best to stay on track, but the bottles are popped. Hey guys.
Hi, welcome back to Death by Champagne.
We're here bringing you your next book installment.
It took so long, but here we are.
It took very long. Well, I feel like a couple weeks we were just like waiting for the book. We did not plan this one quite as ahead.
Right.
As the other ones.
Because we didn't decide. Ready
with a book.
Yeah. When we should have already had the book and been planning, we decided and ordered it. And then that took a long time. Yeah. So there were a lot of regular episodes in between, but that's fine.
It's fine. We are here now. But before we dive into that, I have some fun things to talk about.
Tell me all your things.
I mean, our book is actually very fun. We're like bringing you something much more lighthearted than normal. But we started Lovecraft Country on HBO.
I have not yet. I'm so excited.
So fucking good. Like episode one is incredible. Yeah.
Maybe I'll watch that right after this if I can stay awake. Yes, I should preface this whole episode with I've been up since 4:30 in the morning and it's 8:30 p.m.
Too long, girl. Too long. Well, we won't make this intro 20 minutes so we can like dive in. But Lovecraft Country is very good. And then I also read a whole article about like everything that kind of it's stemming from, like with H.P. Lovecraft being like super fucking racist and not a good guy at all. But that, like, his writings are so ingrained in horror, it's not something you can just eliminate, unfortunately. I'll have to find that article and, like, link to it because it was really, really good. Because I didn't, I mean, I have a couple of his, like, short story books, you know, like, books with a bunch of his stories in it.
I think we probably have the same one. I have, like, a giant compendium that was on sale for $10 at Barnes & Noble.
Yeah, and I mean, I've not read through that many, but it was just interesting to read this article about and like what Lovecraft Country is trying to do, like reshape his genre of horror by having black actors as the protagonists and as the nerds who are fighting these creatures. Yeah.
Hell yes.
Yeah. It's very good. We also started, we stumbled across, what's it called? Blood Ride. And it's in French. We didn't know that till we started it. But then it was like, okay, here we go. But it's, they're all different stories every episode. So like you're on this bus and you see these people on this creepy fucking bus. And like the very first episode, you see like this girl on the bus and she's looking at her hands and they're covered in blood. And then it goes to like her story. So like the next episode will be some other people on the bus and why they're on the bus. And we don't really know where the bus is going. Our guess is
hell.
That's
fun.
I don't know. Yeah.
I like that. I've never heard of that.
Yeah, it's very good. I would recommend it.
The blood on the like anything on a bus now reminds me of, what is it, The Perfectionist?
Oh, yeah. Ooh, yeah.
That movie, I was so confused for a while, and then I got really into it, and then at the end, I was like, this is very excessive. You know, and then it was the dumbest thing. It was her hairstyle at the end that pushed me over the edge. I was like, no one does their hair like this. Yeah. No one ever. Like, is she a cartoon come to life?
Yeah, yeah. I still liked it.
I also just could not be more critical of something I know nothing about. There could be a full explanation out there, and I would just be like, why'd you do it that way?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, I have nothing to report on the reading and watching TV front because I've been reading and writing for this series. So all I've done when I decompress from all my jobs and my responsibilities is still rot my brain with 90 Day Fiancé.
So hey, that was like our best get vocal.
It was honestly unreal. Thank you. First of all, let me just name everyone off the top of my head that I can remember. We had our patrons. Carlos and Robbie were in there. I don't know who it was from Weird Distractions podcast. That podcast has multiple hosts.
Yeah.
But Weird Distractions was on there. Lainey from True Crime Fan Club. Jenny from It's Murder Up North. Fern from Evidence of a Crime. And Jolene, God bless it, Jolene from Hometown Homicide. All came on and we spent an hour and a half talking about the criminal records of a lot of the people on 90 Day Fiancé. And if you want to rewatch it, it's still up on our Get Vocal channel. But I laughed so hard through the whole thing. It was so awesome to talk about Paul Staley with other people.
Yeah, it was really fun.
It was great too because Olivia doesn't watch that show. So I sent her an episode guide of clips to watch.
Which was great.
And it was very organized. A treat.
Yeah, it was pretty great.
It was fun.
That was for sure one of our more successful get vocals. So
yeah, I still really like the idea. Yeah, I like the idea of using that platform to talk about open cases or missing people. But
oh, yes.
Using that time also to just hang out with people in our circle and talk about funny shit was so great.
Yeah, it was very nice.
It was a very nice break.
Agreed. Ooh, I mean, I posted it on social media, but I got my dress. That's a thing.
Yeah, we can talk about that.
That is a thing. And Mackenzie got to come with me this time.
I got to see the wedding dress in person.
Yes, so exciting.
Looks like a literal fucking angel for the first and last time in your life.
Right. Truth. I still need to call people to have it altered, but it's hanging in my closet right now.
You have time because that it doesn't need many alterations.
I know, that's true. I'm like, a hem will not take long. I could really do that if I really had to.
You have skills.
I don't want to hem
it. I can't sew
it,
but a fucking button. My theory with tasks I don't know or don't want to do them, like I don't know how or I don't want to, is like I'll just pay someone to do that for me, right?
That's true. That is very true.
Big proponent of that. We were just talking about buying a house and I was like, just let it be known right now before we even make the purchase, I will never mow the grass.
Right. Yeah.
I've never done it. I don't want to do it. I don't want to spend my time doing it.
No, I've mowed the grass once, not here, but like at my house in my family's house where I grew up. I did it one time. That was
I would much rather save my time for things I enjoy and then pay someone else to do it who could benefit from that money.
Yes, exactly. Totally agree.
Yeah, I have to spend all my time reading all of our books.
Yeah, that too.
And that's my whole day.
I'm actually very excited that I finished this today because now I can read a different book.
I know. I have two at the library that I haven't even picked up.
Oh, sad day.
What do I
have?
I
can order books at the library again. I need to start that.
Yeah, I have My Sister, the Serial Killer.
Ooh. Wait, I have that book, don't I?
I don't know. I have it right now from the library. And then I have two other ones that I literally can't even remember what they are.
Well,
Little Fires Everywhere.
Oh, nice.
Because I refuse to watch it until I read it.
Yes. Which, that one didn't get, like, renewed, right?
I have no idea. I've avoided all
anything about it. I feel like it was that. And people are mad because everything I've seen about it, people fucking love it.
I guess I'll see.
Yeah.
All right. Should we dive into this?
Yes.
All right. So we've got a long list of sources for this. And I assume throughout my half of the book, it's going to get longer. I kind of had more of the in the beginning of the book, we split this book in half. So we're both reading all of it, but I am writing and taking notes for the first half and Liv took over the second part. So the beginning is really explaining, first of all, the title is The Last Madam, or Madame, however you prefer to say it, A Life in the New Orleans Underworld by Christine Wiltz. So I had a lot of the background of what was happening socioeconomically at the time, how everyone was filtering into New Orleans, and I spent a lot of time, I mean, it was a lot like The Unicorn's Secret, where like I don't know anything about that area.
Right.
About that part of the country, about that time period. So a lot of things that were referenced, I would have to go back and look it up and make sure I understood for context. So obviously, The Last Madam by Christine Wiltz is our main source. Also, an article and episode of Snap Judgment on NPR called The Last Madam, hosted by Glenn Washington, byline by Stephanie Fu. An article called Former French Quarter Brothel Becomes Home Sweet Home by Stephanie Bruno for NOLA.com in 2011. The Best Little Whorehouse in NOLA, Backstory Radio by Diana Williams in March of 2016. The bio of Christine Wiltz on her website, ChristineWiltz.com. An article called The Last Days of Storyville by Sally Asher, MyNewOrleans.com, September of 2017. The History Behind Five of New Orleans' Favorite Mardi Gras Traditions by Olivia Waxman, Time.com, February 2018, and 1026ContiST.com. So today we start our series on Norma Wallace, called Queen of the French Quarter Underworld by author Christine Wiltz. Wiltz's book, The Last Madam, A Life in the New Orleans Underworld, profiles Norma's rise out of poverty into a position of power as a madam in 1930s New Orleans. This book isn't our typical true crime selection, but we thought it would be insightful to pick this one and focus on women in power in the sex industry. Not something we typically see. So even though, I think for context, you have to keep in mind that, I say it again later, but even though there is no blatant racism in the first section of this book, we have to assume it was there. We have to assume that sex workers, you know, that job, that occupation, that lifestyle carried stigma by people outside of the community. It really is celebrated in a way in the book because Norma is the focus, but you get no outside look other than through the lens of local law enforcement and government who want to shut down the sex work industry.
Yes.
So keeping in mind that even though it feels really fun because you don't have to be reminded of those things, it happened.
It happened, yes. And Norma is white, so she got the treatment she did from a lot of this because she was white.
Yes.
Yeah.
100%. And there is an interesting dynamic that hopefully I have in here later to mention that it was like the area that they were working in was very integrated for the time, but I still believe fully that things were not great
for sure
between all of those people sharing the space South together
in this time period that we'll be talking about. Yeah, for sure was not.
Yeah, I think hearing the details the way that they're written, it would be easy to forget that
for sure.
So a little bit about Christine Wiltz. She's an author who is proudly from New Orleans, and most of her work, fiction or non, centers around New Orleans as the setting. She began writing about Norma Wallace after she was able to listen to tapes that Norma recorded of herself telling her own life story. From Christine's bio on her own website, she says, "To be born in New Orleans is simply a terrific piece of luck, especially if you're a raconteur, but then every person you meet anywhere has a story they'd like to tell. In New Orleans, they don't hesitate. This is a city where creativity flourishes, from the downtown art scene to the dialogues overheard in the aisles of the grocery store. Another piece of luck is that my mother happened to be a reader and liked mysteries. I write mystery sometimes. There was no way to avoid that after my mother read Sherlock Holmes stories to me at bedtime for years. She gave me a way to escape and eventually a profession, and I have run with it ever since. She goes on to say that she read The Long Goodbye and wanted to write about New Orleans the way Raymond Chandler wrote about L.A. She started that venture with three detective novels centered around a character named Neil Rafferty. So, opening The Last Madam, and I actually read a couple this morning of the reviews and praise for the book, just because I felt like I didn't immediately get as big of a sense. Like, after I found so much information online about, like, obviously, all the authors of all the Gary Ridgway books and, like, Stephen Levy, I just needed more information, I felt like. So, from Entertainment Weekly, it just says, juicy and jaunty. And then from Valerie Martin, author of Mary Riley, she writes, in New Orleans, the water table is so high, the underworld is never far beneath. The Last Madam is a fascinating study of the unrivaled mistress of that world, delightful and serious by turns, an insider's look at an insider's life in a city both know and love. I enjoyed all of the feedback about this book.
Yeah. Because
I think it really is something that, like, this is getting optioned for a movie, and I need that to happen.
Oh, this is?
Yes.
Oh.
Someone has, it's like in talks to be produced. It's been made a play.
Ooh, so yes.
It is possibly going to be made into a film, and I want it.
I mean, it's written like you're following along with a movie.
Oh,
like it's written very well in that sense. Like it could be easily adapted.
In the beginning, you're kind of going back and forth between like the actual timeline, things that happened later, things that happened in the past. It's a little confusing to put together in a way that makes sense, but I think it would translate fantastically to screen. And then I wrote in our firm content warning that there is dated and possibly offensive language used concerning women, sex workers, and as we're in the turn of the century New Orleans, there is absolutely racism, even where it is not put on display in the book. I try to be sensitive throughout the series concerning use of the words whore and prostitute.
Oh God, whore is used. We should have counted.
Oh,
so many times.
100, at least.
But it was like not, I don't know, I feel like because a lot of times it was quotes, like someone, even Norma, calling it a whorehouse. And it's like,
oh yeah,
that's just what it was.
Like, yeah.
I don't know. It wasn't like offensive, really. I don't know.
Yeah. Even if that was like a derogatory term given by outsiders or people who would never have gone in that neighborhood, let alone a whorehouse themselves, that's what they called it.
Yeah.
So, Norma Lenore Baden. I want to pronounce it French and say Badon.
That's what I thought it was.
I hope it's that. But she was born in Mississippi, so I don't know.
So maybe not.
It might be Baden. Norma Lenore was born in McComb, Mississippi in 1901. My first note to myself was, go find her actual birthday. Why the fuck don't you have it? She lied all the time about her age, so people really aren't even sure if she was born in 1901, but that's the best estimation.
Gosh, that's so crazy.
I love it.
Yeah.
When she was 3 months old, her parents moved their family to New Orleans. Norma's parents were John Golly Baden, originally from Covington, Louisiana, and her mother was Amanda Easley Baden, daughter of the first mayor of Macomb. Norma is followed by a son named Elmo around 5 years later. Their life in New Orleans and the family history overall is painted in many shades by Norma, depending on what story you read by what source. Chris Wiltz cites Norma's tapes to say that she recorded nothing about her childhood at all, up until the age of 12. Bar one tale of, quote, the greatest disappointment of her life. So we have no information about her life at all until 12 years old, at least that comes from her. They grew up extremely poor in New Orleans, skipping from house to house to avoid paying outstanding rent. Fully support, because the longer I rent, the more it's a fucking crime.
Yeah.
Not to talk shit about my landlord, because she's great, but there's still a hole in my kitchen ceiling.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Yeah.
It's fine. One of Norma's lasting memories from their life together in the city was hunger. When Norma was 8 years old, there was never food in the house, and they lived near a bakery on Salcedo Street. She smelled their specialty of lemon pies when going to and from the house, but the pies cost 10 cents each. For comparison, when she says that they would move to skip rent, Rent could be around $8 at this time, and paying someone to haul their belongings to a new address was $2. If I did the math, like, based on percentages, that would be like me paying $45 for a pie.
Right, yeah. Oh,
and man, that does not include inflation.
So. Yeah, jeez.
Norma continually asked her mother to splurge on one of the lemon pies, and she finally heard yes when they had a boarder move in. Norma doesn't remember where he slept or how he fed himself, since there was no food, but she did remember that every time she saw him, he had a bottle of Four Roses bourbon.
That's how he fed himself.
Right, he didn't need food. Yeah. It was fine. His name was Mr. McCann, and he was always drunk. Amanda told Norma when they got McCann's next rent payment, she could get her a pie. The day before rent was due, all Norma could think about was the scent of lemon, but that evening, her mother went out in the yard and, quote, she came back pretty shook up. Mr. McCann had drunk carbolic acid, and he was dead.
Ugh, not a good way to go.
No, not at all. So, Wiltz notes smartly that this one story from Norma's childhood is told in a very humorous light. And I think that that's because even though she was still young, the other stories Norma tells her tape recorder don't feel like acts of childhood. If poverty didn't force her to grow up fast enough, her father moved out after discovering his wife in bed with another man, and Amanda, her mother, all but abandoned Norma and Elmo in the French Quarter after that. Her father is called Golly in the book. He's John Golly, but apparently we go by Golly. So after he left, he started a new family in Slidell, Louisiana, and he still had money problems and liked to drink, so his dreams of success were less than fulfilled despite one of his own brothers becoming the mayor. And as cited by Wiltz, Norma told her sister-in-law she knew her mother wanted to come to New Orleans to live the wild life, and Amanda dragged Norma into the underworld with her. She reportedly introduced her daughter to prostitution and would disappear for weeks at a time, leaving Norma to care for Elmo, who was only 7. He would steal food for the pair of them until some of the black families that lived around them noticed that they had no support at all. They helped the kids out when they could, and Norma would repay them later when she was older. Also, when Norma gave any interviews or talked about her life later, she would not go into detail about how her parents treated her, even though there was evidence. Like, people could give, you know, before now, when people wanted to interview her in the 70s, or I haven't finished the book, I don't know when she dies. So when she was, you know, older in life, people were still around that could testify to how she grew up. Mm-hmm. If they said shitty things about her family, she would not confirm it. She would just be like, we're not going to talk about it. Mm-hmm. But the circumstances she was raised in are exactly what set her up to seek a life of power through the sex industry. She was very loyal, and she knew to be respected, you kept your mouth shut about family bullshit.
Yep. All right, so this part's mine. New Orleans or Memphis? A little unclear. If Norma's first experiences working as a sort of call girl happened in New Orleans or Memphis. There are several names for the part of town where sex workers, pimps, and the other societally shunned ne'er-do-wells did their business. One common name was Storyville, the last name of the alderman that gave the go-ahead for brothels to operate in that section of town was Story. Another name was the Tenderloin District. From 1897 to 1917, sex work was legal in that 16-block square. On the surface, this legislation was... can't say legislation. Okay. On the surface, this legislation was trying to accomplish the thing we all want for sex work. Make it legal, provide a safe space to do it, and then the city, in return, collects taxes there. And everybody wins. Right?
No.
This is America. Sex workers can't win. And they couldn't in the early 1900s either.
Oh, yeah. So I'll jump in at this part. This is where I started going outside the book for sources.
Okay.
And it was listed, confining sex work to one area also, quote, took temptation and open insult out of the path of respectable females.
What?
Great.
What?
Can't. Unacceptable.
Yeah, no. So what ends up happening is an influx of harsh and greedy landlords who were largely unregulated and violence from various clients and pimps and corrupt officers and city officials. It's also a little backwards to think that a lot of people want to venture into the, quote, prostitution neighborhood, head held high, and find someone for services. This plan didn't allow for secrecy in many ways. So if Norma didn't get her initial foray into sex work in New Orleans, it happened in Memphis. Norma went there to stay with some cousins for a while, and she was awestruck at the scenes at the Gayoso Hotel. Is that how?
Yeah, Gayoso? I think it's Gayoso.
Gayoso Hotel. Women she described as spectacular flitted around the Lux Hotel, and Norma decided she could be one of them. She was pretty in a distinguished way, but Norma's best quality was her personality. She was confident, smart, and bold. For the first scheme to pick up a man, she got some school books and wore a big hat to make herself seem older, like she was walking to classes. A veterinarian named Dr. Sylvester was the first to ask her out. He asked if they could go to dinner, and she said, yeah, at the Gayoso Hotel. He was 60, and she was 14. She lied.
14 years old.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of statutory rape happening in this whole book.
100%
Two men and, well, not even men, boys. Two boys and girls. Both.
Yes. And, I mean, I think it's this is another area where, like, throughout the whole time you have to like, wade through this internal, like, yes, that's what it is, but that's also what we applied to it from present day knowledge and understanding of, like, children cannot consent. But also, these children, a lot of the time, are faced with circumstances where, yeah, they make a choice to do this because they see that that's the only way that they can... the only way that they can pay bills and get food on the table,
which is horrific. That, or even the other way around, it's fathers or uncles bringing their children to brothels to lose their virginity, like, intentionally when they're like 12 years old.
Yes. Like, it's all very, very concerning. People, I mean, I don't know. I think my lens on things always has a religion filter. But, like, just people who you would never expect that are just, why are adults obsessed with sex at this time? Seriously. Obsessed with it. Absolutely. But it's also disgusting.
Yeah. Yeah. Weird. Anyway, she lied her way through a multi-course meal saying that she was 17. Wilt chooses her words carefully here and said that Sylvester chose to believe her and continued seeing her. Norma knew he was after sex and she wanted clothes, but she had yet to sleep with anyone and decided Dr. Sylvester would not be the first. She strung him along, accepting his gifts, but never letting him have her. He stopped seeing her after 6 weeks of unreturned favors. So she knew. She was 14. She knew how to play the game early on. She's like, I'm going to flaunt it all to you. Get what I want. Milk this as long as I can, and then peace the fuck out.
Right. Like, the half of me that's constant. Not like, oh my God, this is what she had to do to survive in this world. I'm so sorry that no one took care of you. The other half of me is like, I wish I hadn't been desperate for men's attention at 14.
Right.
Like, I would rather have had the attitude of Norma. We're like, what can I get out of this?
Sure. Yes. How much money are they willing to give me? Because.
Whereas I was like sweating at the bowling alley because someone so-and-so like wouldn't talk to me.
Ew. Yeah. Yeah.
Hate. If I could go back in time and punch myself in the fucking face from the ages of 12 to 15, I would.
Absolutely. I think everyone would probably do that to themselves. Mm-hmm. So Norma's next fling was not so kind as to just stop calling on her. Andy Wallace was a bootlegger and, quote, deadly good looking in every woman in Memphis and within a gunshot beyond knew it. He put Norma up in an apartment, and though they were never legally married, she began going by Norma Wallace. Wiltz writes that Norma felt like if she was going to continue sex work, she didn't want to use her family's name anyway. The times with Andy were erratic at best and a chaotic fever pitch when they were fighting. He liked Norma, but he liked seeing other women too, and she was too young to know what she was getting into. She laughs upon recounting the idea that she would be able to tame him. Quote, I tell you what I got for my trouble. I got shot. Well, I also got a seven carat diamond ring.
Which... just the quote to open up this, like, this is the story that sets the scene for a lifetime of, like, you think it can't get more dramatic or more just, like, larger than life. And she's like, yeah, I got shot. But you know what's more important than that?
Right.
I got a 7-carat diamond ring.
And that ring will come into play later. You haven't read it yet, but...
things happen. I can't wait. I can't wait to hear about it. I also don't know the background. Do you hear later in the book of how she got shot?
No, I have yet to get there. And if I did, it did not. I feel like it's like talked about so fleetingly that it like it's never like, here's the story. It's like you get little tidbits of it maybe throughout.
For as far as you are, there's definitely no story then.
Okay.
It does say in one sentence that I caught that she got grazed in the ankle.
Yes.
So I think it was probably a situation where she was either running away or they were chasing each other and fighting.
Right. Or even like an accident. I mean, honestly, no, like listening or reading this book, like she's pretty fucking dramatic. Like it could have very well been an accident. And then she's just claiming that he shot her. I don't know.
It gets very, very wild at times.
Yeah,
so
yeah, who knows?
All right. So in 1916, Norma's 15 years old and she returns to New Orleans. She's ready to work the city to her advantage. Wiltz writes that before she left New Orleans for Memphis, she could only survive. After her exposure to the glittering ladies of the night in the City of Blues, she was ready to make her own way.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
She first focused on the Cosmopolitan Hotel, a family place on the corner of Bourbon and Royal. She knew from watching the ladies' entrance that many women going inside at night were on their way to meet dates. I don't know what the ladies' entrance is, but whatever. Fun fact about that hotel. Napoleon, like the Napoleon, his doctor lived in the hotel, and he made a cast of Napoleon's face when he died for death masks.
Oh, jeez.
Only a few were ever made, and one of the bronze casts is still on display in New Orleans somewhere.
Wow, that's a fun fact.
This is where I was like, stop reading about this on other websites. Just talk about the book.
Oh my gosh.
But they're like, I was like, it's New Orleans. You have to know. Anytime someone's mentioned in passing who was like briefly famous, I'm like, well, what did they do? Anyway, this did not go how Norma hoped. The first night she walked into the lobby, all the other call girls spotted her immediately and were like, you are way too young. No one's going to want to go out with you, and we don't want you trying it out here because this is our spot.
Mm-hmm.
So now I have a good quote. It's very long, from the Last Days of Storyville article, describing kind of like what's going on right now in Storyville.
Okay.
So there are multiple areas of town. Storyville is like, it is where it's the designated area. It was like where sex work was allowed to happen. So, quote, the off-romanticized image of beautiful women dressed in silk and lounging on velvet chaises with the sounds of clicking champagne glasses and jaunty jazz music flowing out of the windows of a three-story mansion was more fantasy than reality of Storyville. The pleasure district, on so many levels, wasn't. The social stratification was as extreme in the underworld as in was the upper classes, and the very distinct rungs existed on all levels. There was a wide spectrum of madams, prostitutes, and others, all trading their services on sliding scales. Although the creation of Storyville was primarily meant to protect women, albeit white women, and property owners, it ultimately left those most vulnerable exposed to corruption and violence. The red lights of the district may have dimmed in 1917, but its legacy and legend have lasted a century since. So, again, exterior source giving us some good context that all the nice things we're reading about don't apply to everyone involved.
Right. Yes.
But just as it would seem, whorehouses were on the decline in New Orleans. Norma Wallace was just getting started. So in 1917, like, big vice cops and the mayor was like, we're not doing this anymore. Yes. There was this like, it goes back and forth a lot through the book. Like, whoever happens to be mayor or the police captain at the time is really influential on how they do business.
Mm-hmm.
Certain people will come into power and ruin everything and try to take it away. Other people will come into power and not give a shit. And the cops, like, just do whatever their boss says. So if the big guns don't care,
then no,
they just let everything slide.
Yeah.
But Norma was like, I don't give a shit what happens, Storyville or no Storyville.
Oh, yeah.
I am going to make my money.
Because she was determined to just have everyone in her pocket.
Mm-hmm.
Which is exactly what she ends up doing. So leaving Storyville and the Tango Belt. A few of the madams in Storyville had the foresight to exit the neighborhood before they caught any publicity in the fight to break up the red light district. One of those women was Bertha Anderson. She and a handful of others had discreetly moved their operations to the French Quarter. She was the first house Norma went to after her dismissal from the girls at the Cosmopolitan. Bertha had a good reputation and liked Norma a lot. She even tried to talk her out of working for her. But once she understood that Norma needed to care for her brother and mother, she set out to make Norma competitive and sharp in the business. Norma turned 16 while she was learning the literal tricks of the trades from Bertha's girls. She said she learned two things from Bertha. Never use dope and work it while you can. No one wants to pay for a night with an older woman. Determined to rise above working for dates, Norma set out to be a landlady. Word they used rather than madame's. That was a pretty typical phrase.
Yeah, they only went by landlady because I think it was... Nobody wanted to verbally like say what you're doing. Yeah.
She first tried to open an enterprise in Memphis where there was less market saturation. She ran an apartment with two or three other girls, but quote, the apartment began to get hot and I wanted to go back to New Orleans by then anyway.
The French Quarter at this point in history was a haven for artists, writers, dancers, and sex workers true to the spirit of La Vie Bohème. And then, of course, as I started to look up this phrase, because I know kind of what it means, I hear it used all the time. It's a really popular show tune. The origins of the phrase La Vie Bohème originate in the 19th century French lexicon and was inspired by the nomadic lives of the Roma, commonly and derogatorily referred to as gypsies.
Oh.
So another bit of context that I felt was relevant to bring to the table was that when you're saying La Vie Bohème, like, I don't know if people find that offensive or if now that we're reckoning with the way that we treat Roma people,
right,
if that's still acceptable, I don't know. Because I was just like, oh, this is a good phrase to describe it. And then I was like, you actually don't know what that means.
Like, what is that? Interesting. Learning all the things today.
Yes.
So Wilt cites John McGill?
Probably McGill.
McGill. John McGill, curator at the Historic New Orleans Collection, for an understanding of the feel of the French Quarter in the early 1920s. It was more French than American. Anyone leading an unconventional life could find a home there that was described by Wilt as
bourgeoisie.
I don't know how to say anything. Anti-bourgeoisie, adventurous, and risque. One particular area of the French Quarter was called the Tango Belt, which was a rougher neighborhood. The Tango Belt gained a rep for nightclubs and dance halls. This name came about because the tango was largely viewed as scandalous. You can even be taken to jail for dancing too sensuously with your partner. The Tango Belt was also very integrated compared to the city around it, which births a common theme we can identify with today. Local officials policing conduct in a neighborhood they could give two shits about.
Not for it.
No. So the Tango Belt was where Bertha was located when Norma returned from Memphis, but Norma sidestepped a re-entry to the French Quarter. She instead moved on to Louise Jackson's house, where she quickly earned a reputation for reliability. Louise had epilepsy, and Norma looked after the place when Louise needed help. Quote from the book, running that large house, three or four maids, and keeping her man out of the money. Norma recalled that she knew she was ready to strike out on her own again when she successfully handed a man dying in the house one night. Apparently, quote, had his pleasure and then conked out. Cannot believe it. And she's like, she's under 20. And she's like,
I think she had like just, she was like on the cusp of 20.
Yeah. And she's like, snaps for me. Like, I'm running this bitch's place and a man died and I got him out of here and the police here with no questions asked. Okay.
Which is just like, imagine if you were in charge of all the other girls at that scenario where everyone's freaking out and you have to be the voice of reason.
Right. Yeah.
In the book, they do mention, like, luckily the girl that he died on top of was able to wiggle out from under him. Yeah. And I'm just like,
yeah,
I would have jumped in the river at that point.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So introducing Norma's next great love, Pete Herman. He was a two-time world champion fighter, but was suffering from failing eyesight after being thumbed.
Ooh.
During a match.
He got a big old thumb right to the eye socket.
Norma and Pete met at a club one night while she was there with her boyfriend, Louis Giacona, and he introduced them. They kept in touch, and when Pete decided to use some of his $500,000 haul from fighting to open a club, he invited Norma to participate. Norma said of this venture, in quotes, "He asked me to come down when he opened the club, and that's when I fell in love with him." Convenient. Norma, I'd have loved him too.
That was my note to myself while I was writing.
Truth, though. Like, truth.
Yes.
So he lets her run her business out of the top floor of the building. She and three girls left Louise's house and moved into 328 Burgundy Street. They did so well, they eventually took over the entire top floor. Norma became a staple of the Tango Belt, avoiding cops as the mayor cracked down on prostitution. The Volstead Act passed in 1919, and Prohibition went into effect on January 17, 1920. The building itself was on a corner, so Norma opened an illegal bar on the other side as a cover for her girls. They could see if the cops were coming on one side and escape out the other. Norma credits the police with forcing her to be so secretive and resourceful. Quote from the book, "With discretion, I got a better class of clientele. I always did say without the police, I'd never have made it 40 years. Wilt notes that attitudes on vice differed in New Orleans depending on who was in power, and in the early 20s, police captain Teddy Ray was hell-bent on cracking down. Quote from page 24, "Historically, the city's attitude towards both prostitution and gambling had been tolerant, but prohibition was no different from anything else illegal in the city. The law was flagrantly disregarded."
So our next section is titled, I'll read this one, "Business Was Booming."
And it was.
As a shocker to no one, the beginning of Prohibition didn't slow Norma down at all. Wilt's comments on how this time built Norma's character. In the 1920s, she established her characteristic pattern of using the very worst circumstances to improve her own. It seemed like the higher the stakes, the higher Norma's profit. One of her girls, a successful woman named Dora Russo, went out on her own and ended up with two houses on the same corner as Norma. There were no less than five madams on that corner of the Tango Belt, and none of them were hurting for cash or clients.
That's insane. I mean, it's not.
This is the part where I romanticize it in my head. And I'm like, this is such a good movie. Someone make a musical about this.
Yes.
Please make a musical about this. I just, all the showgirls I know. I know so many burlesque dancers. So many people who are involved in, stripping, sex work. I'm just yes.
Yeah.
Yes, please do it. So Norma does recall a sad story from this time. A girl she worked with named Blue fell in love with a cop who worked their corner. Rather than trying to arrest the girls, which outnumbered him by the dozen at any turn, he kept the peace by forcing drunk and aggressive men out of their corners. Blue had a boyfriend and never wanted to go out on buyout dates, where a man would pay for the whole evening and take the girl out to a club or a show. She preferred to stay at the house and would step out for breaks. And Norma thought that was to see the boyfriend. But then, the cop happened and she was like, oh, well, she's just seeing the cop, too.
Mm-hmm.
Or now, that's her main squeeze or whatever. But Blue was using heroin. She started seeing the cop and stopped working for Norma, and she was dead within a week from taking mercury tablets. And I tried to look this up. I don't know if she took them as a form of suicide or if she needed to get high and that was all she had. Mercury tablets did have a loose medical use at this time for syphilis. And the note in the book is that the cop said, "I gave her the cure." I don't know if that means he gave her the mercury tablets and
maybe that was thought to help with heroin addiction.
I don't know.
Too.
Either way, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Whatever happened in that situation, Norma was very upset and sad with herself for not realizing what Blue was doing. Cuz she always said she had two policies: no girls on drugs, mm-hmm. and I will not employ women that have pimps.
Yes.
Because I'm not sharing with anyone, yes. and they just bring trouble.
Yes.
So, into the 1920s, Wilt recounts a funny story of the birth of the term Vidalia.
I love this part.
I do too. It's so funny. Norma had a dog named Vidalia that followed her around everywhere, and when a cab driver overheard her talking to the dog, he picked it up and started calling the customers he brought to Norma's to collect Vidalias. It came to mean a variety of things. At first, just a guy looking to get to one of the houses, but then it evolved to be, quote, a sucker from out of town. Mm-hmm. The anecdote that goes along with this etymology starts with two men from New York coming to Norma's house. They asked for every girl in the place to join them, and they drank bootleg liquor all night into the next day. One guy was the main big spender, and his companion was introduced as the secretary. He didn't drink at all and stayed totally sober. The other guy was absolutely trashed. Norma got them steaks for lunch and the party continued. The man never slept with any of the women, just demanded constant company. The wildest he got was requesting that one girl take a bath with him. Their tab at this point was outrageous, and as they got into the second night, every time a girl walked by, he would yell, "Put her down for 20." And occasionally he would like look around the room at all these beautiful women and be like, "Give them all $20.
Yeah.
Which
so
like,
insane.
Again, all I can think is what, like, just think about The Great Gatsby remake.
Oh, yeah.
How good could this be?
It would be great as a movie.
Put it musical. On Broadway. Well, I mean, I guess it's already a play, but I need a big Broadway debut,
songs,
please. So many. So at the end of 3 days, Norma's stomach dropped when he handed her a check for his $4,500 bill. It was risky to take a check, and she would be damned if she was cheated or made a fool of. She called a local bank first thing in the morning, and a friend that worked there told her his bank said a check from him is good for any amount. She ended up getting a $75,000 payout for trusting her gut.
Insane. Yeah, because she called and they were basically like, oh, yes. Like his name. Like that's, you know, like whatever his name was, it was like, oh, no, it's, he's
it wasn't
good
even a question.
For whatever money he spent there.
Mm-hmm. So through the early 20s, Norma had highs and lows. She was arrested 13 times, which, according to Wiltz, was nothing compared to most in the sex work industry, but she never did any jail time. Her old friend Dora Russo had connections, so she could always get girls out, but that didn't last. The police captain, our old friend Teddy Ray, was still doing everything he could to crack down on prostitution. Bars and nightclubs were constantly raided for liquor violations, and whorehouses were being padlocked by the city, their tenants evicted and told they could not resume residency at the premises for at least a year. Which, like,
that's insane.
These women bought these buildings.
Oh, yeah.
They weren't rented.
No, they owned
them. I would be
goddamned
if the city came in and padlocked my residence and said, you don't get to go in. Are you fucking kidding me?
Yeah.
Which also brings me to a relevant today point that we should talk about. Police can seize citizens' money and assets when they are arrested, and it's a problem.
It's a major problem.
Because at first I was like, how could this happen? That the police could just be like, yeah, you can't go in your own house. Fuck off.
I have no idea. Yeah, no idea.
It still happens. Yeah, I don't know if the government or police are allowed to seize houses, but I know they can take your cars.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Dislike.
Yeah.
So Norma's good fortune was running slim, and she knew she needed to reinvent herself again to keep her and her girls surviving.
So in 1928, Norma and Pete's relationship was on the decline. Their businesses took up all their time, and Norma wouldn't put anything before taking care of her money and her girls. A woman Norma admired named Glenn Evans did business on Dauphine Street, but there was no flashing for advertising or having girls pose naked in windows. It was secretive and successful when others were finding themselves shut down. All customers came to them in taxis from the bars and restaurants, never just drunks walking up the street. Norma leased a new building at 410 Dauphine and renovated it to suit new standards. When Norma first started operating her business out of 410 Dauphine, she knew she wanted it to be different than anywhere she worked in her brief period as a sex worker before turning into a madame. She wanted respect, money, and power, and she wanted her girls to be respectable. In the early years, her girls would only wear the finest clothing, no bright lipstick or nail polish, very muted and classy, which I thought was, like, hilarious. She was literally like, oh, if she came down with red lipstick on, I'd tell her to get her ass back upstairs and wipe it off.
Like, which is such... It is such a turn, because I think that's what we all think of. And I think it's
for
mostly
sure.
correct.
Yeah.
That things like garish lipstick and bright red fingernails were a sign at the time.
Oh, yeah. My grandma had literally said that to me when I was in high school, because when I had red nails, like, she told me what it meant when she was, you know, a teenager. Like,
oh, that girl's fast.
Yeah. Yeah. I was like, what? It's a color. Cat.
Get the fuck off the table.
So they also saw a doctor twice a week and were only allowed to work if they were cleared there. She would fire a girl if she found out she was working outside of her establishment or if she was taking advantage of drunk men. Again, Norma knew her clients would be these men and wanted them to feel comfortable and trusted at her house. So yeah, she was very adamant of, like, do not take more money than, you know, what is supposed to be done. Like, don't steal
money. I get
money.
Why. Because you have absolutely no protection as a woman who is breaking the law for a living if someone comes back and accuses you later. But I would be so tempted. I think this says a lot about my personality. And I think probably yours too. Sorry to everyone that fucking hates Harry Potter references consistently, but Slytherin, I think if a drunk man held out his wallet and was like, take what you're owed, I would have been like, okay, all of it, bye.
Oh, I don't know if I should say this, but I have
literally. But you've turned tricks and stolen wallets?
Not quite, but there was this man who one time approached me and Brittany and some other girls we were with. It was literally the end of the night at Sasha's, and he adamantly wanted to buy us all a round of drinks, and it's like 1 a.m. and we're literally leaving. He wouldn't stop. He was so fucking drunk, and we're like, okay, we didn't drink any of the drinks he bought us. He passes out at the table. And then, like, the people working there are like, well, we're, like, closing down. And I was like,
oh, my God.
Fuck off. That's what you get for bothering people who did not want to be bothered. Yes. Okay. So she also taught her girls how to have safe, at least as safe as you could be, unprotected sex. Every time a man was brought upstairs, the selected girl would wash him. It turned into a very sensual experience in a way for, like, newbies to this lifestyle to feel more comfortable.
Well, can I interrupt you and say what I thought about when I read this part that you wrote?
What?
That movie Pierce.
Wait, what movie?
Isn't it called Pierce? Where she like stabs herself in the leg.
Why do I not?
We watched it at my house alone. It was the last time we ever had Marco's pizza together.
Oh, yes.
We watched that movie where she stabs herself. Yes. I think it was called Pierce or something. Synonymous.
Yes.
Yeah. When she was like, yeah, wash him by the bathtub. And I was like, yeah. And then she stabs him in the throat.
Yes. Oh my gosh. That's funny. So while the girl is washing this man, who's there for sex, obviously, she's instructed to look for any distinguishing marks or scars. This would help if they ever needed to blackmail him, like in the future, you know, which happens later on. They would then milk the man's penis in order to check for any diseases. I don't know if this is real or not. I meant to look it up, totally forgot. But Norma informed them that if the sperm that you milk out feels gritty in any way, they're not clean, and they need to get the fuck out of the house right now. They're not allowed to be there.
My interpretation of this is that if you have some sort of STI, your sperm or, like, pre-ejaculate might not feel normal. I think that gritty is possibly a weird term to use.
Right.
Unless that is a common symptom.
Sand. Like, right?
Right. That's what I think of. Right. But I really hesitate to use the word that's coming to mind. Plug your ears if you're grossed out. Chunky is the word that comes to mind.
I hate that.
So unless gritty is actually an accurate description of a symptom that I'm not familiar with, thank God.
Right.
I think that any abnormality that you can feel quite clearly is an indicator that you should run screaming away from that person.
Yeah. So for the girl's safety, the doors were not allowed to be locked when a trick was being turned. If a man even tried to lock the door, he was kicked out and never allowed back. Norma was smart and careful when operating her business, which is one of the reasons why it lasted so long. So with a new regiment in place, Norma's clientele was elevated like never before. Long gone were the days of chasing drunks out of her parlor. She described her customers at 410 Dauphine as the good men. Quote from the book, these were the men who had the real power in New Orleans. They controlled the money. They met in the boardrooms at their banks or the card rooms at their clubs, where they made the decisions that affected most of the city, often without a single elected official present. She also said that these men belonged to old line secret carnival organizations. I don't have a great grasp of how this all went down because it's truly a historical event to be covered on its own, but some of the groups listed by Wiltz via Norma Wallace are Comus, Momus, Proteus, and Rex, King of the Carnival. The group Comus put on the first Mardi Gras parade with themed floats in 1857, formerly known as the Mystic Crew of Comus. They were very secretive about all their events and affairs, other than the large parade they carried out every year. According to an article on Time.com, the in quotes, the organizers came from Mobile, Alabama, which had been hosting similar festivities ever since French-Canadian explorer Pierre Lemoyne d'Iberville.
D'Iberville.
He threw a party when he landed in the Gulf Coast city, which he called Pointe du Mardi Gras, on Fat Tuesday in 1699.
That is one quote that I found from one article. Don't fight me about those facts. So it was a week before Mardi Gras when there was an uncommon incident at Norma's house. A very drunk man came in looking for a good time. He had just won big gambling and was ready to throw some money around for the women. Norma thought he must be practicing for the, quote, Bacchanalian events to come. This man was one of the kings of those four main Mardi Gras crews. A very big deal as far as kicking off and concluding the festivities. He was waving a scepter around, tipping freely, but they were having a hard time getting him to actually take any girls upstairs. Norma tried to get him to go with two girls in hopes that two would be able to handle him and would be exciting, but he demanded Norma's company. It would only be good enough for the king of the carnival to have the madam of the house. And it would be a really big deal if that happened, because no one could ever have the madam as part of a paid deal. She could not be kept by customers at the cost of her respect. So Norma shrugged him off, gesturing to all the pretty women he could choose from, but he kept insisting on her company, finally pulling out a load of money that she described as big as a head of lettuce, and was forcibly shoving it down her bra. She pulled back from him, hesitantly, really wanting the cash, but not for what it would cost her. He pulled her into the center of the room on the hardwood floor, begging for a dance, but she still said no. As she resisted, he became more and more angry, and it turned into him shoving her rather than grabbing her and trying to make her dance. So it's just like a playful tussle at first, and then he's like, are you fucking kidding me? You're really not going to dance with me? And she's like, no, I'm not, and shoves him back. And he slips on the floor, and he smashed his head open on the machine that people put coins in to pay for music. He was bleeding and furious. He wouldn't let her call for help, so she called her old lover, Pete's brother, whose name is Gaspar Galata. Fantastic. Yeah. She called him to come deal with it. And they all decide together. Unfortunately, the only thing they could do to get him out of the house is call the cops. A very hard choice for Norma. The war against sex work had relaxed in the last couple of years, so they hoped they could get off with no charges. When the cops came to take him, they wanted the cop to take him to a hotel, but he was still unruly. She ended up collecting the money that was everywhere and gave it to the cop. She's like, yeah, I was pulling money out of the couch cushions, off the mantle. Like, girls were finding it, like, behind that, like, it's stuck in their clothes. There was just dollars everywhere. And they all took it and gathered it up and gave it to the cop and said, you take this and please don't take him to jail. Because they were like, we don't want him to have a bad experience. Mm-hmm. He's king of the carnival. This could be really fucking bad publicity.
Yeah.
And this man pulled a fucking dick move the next day. And when he woke up with a throbbing headache and he was down $2,500, he called the cops and said Norma rolled him. With the money gone, she had no choice but to accept the accusation. She said of the incident, I guess you could say we crowned him king. And that is where we'll stop this for this week.
Okay.
Next week, we have a few more of Norma's encounters at her house at 410 Dauphine, including appearances by silver screen actresses, mob men, and a group of undertakers.
So exciting.
It is. It's a little misleading that I give you those things and they're all each one story, but they're so good.
That's all we have for you this week.
It was so fun. I'm so glad we picked this book.
Me too. It is way more light. I mean, there's obviously a ton of crime in it. Hello. Everyone is committing a crime in this book. Every single person is talked about.
Oh, yeah.
Is committing like,
technically,
a crime.
Technically, all of it is a crime.
Yes. Yes. So it's just not our typical murdery.
Right.
But.
And I think it's so relevant to look at all of this stuff and be like, yeah, it's a crime. But like, is it hurting anyone?
No.
Who?
Zero.
Like,
people.
Who is. Yeah. Like, what's more important? The sex work that's happening that's technically illegal, or all of the horrible conditions that are forcing people into situations that they, you know, some people willingly were like, yeah, I would much rather be a sex worker than do anything else.
Yeah.
Or like Norma was like, I knew that this was the best way for me to have the kind of life I wanted. Yes, so I just went with it. Sure. And it is what it is. Versus all of the situations like law enforcement putting people into positions they don't want to be in.
Yep.
So as usual, until next week, you can find us on social media. You can find us on Instagram and Twitter at Dead From Champs, Facebook at Death by Champagne Podcast. And if you want to support the show, you can find us on patreon.com/deathbychampagne. There is one tier still up, updates to come. For just $2 a month, you can have an extra episode, and all of the episodes are now ad-free since we have moved to Spreaker. Side note that I'm going to put into my weird random plug at the end of this. If you get random out-of-place advertisements in your episodes, let me know, because I feel like some people do and some people don't.
Yeah, keep us posted on that.
Trying to figure that out, let me know. And if you want to support the show, but things like Patreon aren't really for you, you don't want to participate that way, we would just love you to tell your friends about the show, listen, review, rate, and subscribe on iTunes or Podchaser or whatever app that you are able to listen on, and comment or review. So I guess until next time,
we're here to keep you up at night.
Hail Satan.
And pop some bottles.
And I am fucking ready for this. Oh, it's bad. I'm pissed. That was good.
Oh, that one was good.
There we go.
There we go. That one's good.
Yes.
Bye.
Good. Bye.